Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Today we're going from D-Day to now shoot for the moon. And
how different could it be?
Yeah, well, it's all fake news. So we're talking with the author. Great book. I've been listening to it, and I that's the only thing I can say. I recommend it totally. Jim Donovan, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Well, now let's start out with what brought you to writing about Apollo 11 and just the whole moon aspect and putting a book out?
Yeah, good question. A few points. Most people living today were not alive or old enough to remember the first moon landing, 1969. The median age in this country is somewhere around 38, so vast majority of people living today were not alive for it. And even worse than that, an alarmingly large number of them don't even believe it really happened. I don't know how that happened, but, it's part of this increasing strain of anti-science I see. But anyway, I thought a lively and an accurate account of the event was sorely needed to kind of counter that trend and remind people of this spectacular event. That's one point. Another one is it's just a great story. Not only, I think, the greatest technological achievement of all time. I think it beats the Panama Canal and the Great War, the Great Wall, all to heck. But it's a great story of adventure and exploration. And, there's the phrase American exceptionalism that's been kind of hijacked in recent years. And I think this is an example of American exceptionalism in the most positive sense. And the third reason is when I was a kid, I loved science fiction and space. Reading about it, watching it on TV and in movies, and these guys are my heroes. When someone suggested this idea, I just couldn't say no.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. And just you saying that made me think about science fiction. Like, I'm in my 50s, and I remember I loved all the old science fiction movies and shows and the space race and the whole deal. Nowadays, there's a totally different outlook on science and space, and there's all sorts of craziness. So, I just see how that's changed. It's almost like people are living the fantasy now,
I don't think, the good thing is that I haven't seen, I don't think it's just me. I think it's a fact. I just haven't seen this much interest in space and space travel and exploration since the Apollo 11 moon landing. You see it in movies, books, TV. There's so many shows on it, and you know all the commercial aspects with SpaceX, Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, and other companies. I'm still gobsmacked by that image of, you know, the Tesla with the astronaut in it cruising around the Earth.
Yeah.
I mean, boy, that's got to be one of the greatest advertising gimmicks of all time. But, I mean, it just points up the fact of, you know, how much interest there is in this. You know, what Musk has done, he overpromises sometimes and doesn't, you know, reach his grandiose deadlines, but he's getting a lot done. And I bet you anything he goes to the moon before NASA's proposed 2032 mission.
Well, yeah, you know, whoever's got the best TV set will get there first.
Yeah. But there's so much interest in space and space travel. And, you know, there's also, as we mentioned, the commercial aspects of it. NASA, its budget, you know, at the time in the mid-60s, at the height of the space race and in the middle of Apollo, its budget was something like almost 5% of the national budget, if you can believe that. Unbelievable. Because it was a high-priority thing. But right after that, it tumbled, and now it's something like 0.5%.
Mm.
So NASA has always had these great plans and dreams, but they just haven't had the budgets to put them into implementation. And now, you know, these billionaires with their companies are working with NASA, and, you know, they're going to make it happen sooner rather than later, I think.
Yeah, and one thing about this, you know, we just did the Chernobyl show, and I found it to be similar in the sense that there's always this, especially in the 60s, a huge race of the U.S. and Russia, and that was in having a nuclear reactor and a plant that run energy first, and this one, the Cold War, also brought on this between Russia and the U.S. to get to space. And there was a real panic that Russia was ahead of the U.S. And so that I found that to be one of the most interesting aspects, even about the Apollo 11 and the book.
Well, as you know, you've read enough of the book. Whenever I do a book or on an event, I like to put it in context and go back and show how we got there. So I really start where the story and the space race starts in October 1957, where, you know, the fat cat America, we were just sitting there, you know, still basking in the post-war glow of, you know, being the conquerors and the winners, and we split the atom, and we're the smartest guys on the block, and all of a sudden, boom, October 4th, Sputnik goes up, this little beach ball-sized sphere, the first artificial satellite circling the Earth, and going over the United States and beep, beep, beeping its way around. And, of course, it sent Americans into a frenzy. What was next? And, you know, nuclear bombs dropped from us, a space station, a moon base. This was the height of the Cold War. And people now don't really fully understand, I think, a lot of us, how serious the stakes were. You know, the free world and capitalist, democratic world versus authoritarian communism. And, you know, the defects and weaknesses of communism weren't as known back then. It was very appealing to a lot of smaller, less unaligned, non-aligned nations throughout the world, dozens of them, you know, who are trying to look for indications about which side of this global tug of war to lend a hand to. They wanted to be on the winning side. And what's more obvious and visible than, you know, the space race. So that threw us into a frenzy. And fortunately, both sides of the aisle, Democrat and Republican, got together. And, of course, the Senate leader was Lyndon Johnson, who said, whoever controls space controls the world.
Right.
And it was made a high priority program. And that's how NASA was started and the space race began. But the Soviets were winning the first few years, satellite, first man in space in 1961, Yuri Gagarin, first spacewalk a few years after that, first woman in space, first multi-man crew in space. They were kicking our butts in space until about the middle of Gemini.
Right. Didn't they have the dog up there, too? Didn't they send a dog?
Laika, a dog, went up in the second Sputnik 2, which was a lot larger, and that was a much larger satellite, and it showed clearly that, yes, you know, nuclear bombs could be sent up there if they could do that. And, of course, the other thing was, why would they be sending a dog unless they were planning, they were experimenting and testing the waters with a mammal, and they were planning on sending a man up there, which was obvious, the obvious plan.
Right. Now, JFK wasn't really up for it. Like, most people just think it is. Like, I watched the Apollo 11 movie that was just out, and I know that they promote his speech, but really it was Johnson that was kind of pushing before Kennedy got on.
You're right, Al. It was. Johnson had been interested in space since the late 40s, early 50s, and he kind of understood that, you know, that was the new frontier before Kennedy used that phrase with it. And as I think I mentioned, while Eisenhower was still president in the late 50s, he was pushing for a space program, which got NASA started in 1958. Kennedy wasn't much for space when he got elected, but once he started learning more about it and meeting some of the astronauts and some of the missions began, he warmed up to it a lot. And, of course, in May 1961, he gave that speech challenging the nation to putting a man on the moon and bringing him back safely. That second part important, of course. And actually, part of that was due to a few things. The Bay of Pigs had happened a few weeks before, and the United States looked terrible, of course, because of that, and that was egg on his face also, a major blunder early in his administration. And he needed something big to take people's minds off that, the world's minds off that, and something that could prove we could do something and beat the Russians. And he asked Johnson to take care of that, and Johnson talked to lots of people, Wernher von Braun, of course, the engineer, master engineer, and lots of other people. And they told him, you know, if we really jump for a big goal, land a man on the moon, they don't have, that's going to require huge boosters, huge rockets. We can beat them on that. And that was a lot of the reasons why he gave that speech.
Yeah. You know, one of the other interesting things I think about this is, again, between Russia and the U.S., how they, you know, Operation Paperclip, and how they were trying to assemble a great Nazi engineers and scientists, and they got von Braun for the U.S. What was your thought on him?
He's a fascinating individual, a man, I can't remember his first name, Neufeld, who did a biography of him, the best biography of him, I think cautiously came down on the side of some kind of forgiveness. You know, when he was a young man and in Germany, and of course just loved space travel and the thought of it, and all he wanted to do really as a young man was just, you know, build rockets and go into space. Preferably himself, as, you know, the astronaut or whatever. They didn't have that word yet. In the middle, early 30s, of course, Germany was still restricted as to what they could do militarily in terms of the treaty following World War I. But he was approached by someone in the army to lead a very, you know, primitive missile program, and he did. He was still in grad school at the time, but he was just a fantastic engineer and also a fantastic leader of men, which is kind of underrated. And that program got larger and larger, and, you know, of course, guess who comes into power in 1933? Mr. Hitler. And, you know, pretty soon,
yeah.
It's World War II, and Wernher von Braun had, you know, signed a pact with the devil. He had to continue with them if he wanted to continue with his dream. And, of course, it was subverted to V2 rockets, the first true ballistic missile that could go, you know, several hundred miles and land in reasonable proximity to its target. Did a lot of damage in England and Belgium, I believe. He was kind of forced by Goering to join the SS, even though he didn't want to, but he realized he would have to or he'd be banished or taken out of the program. So he did. And at the end of the war, he and his, about 126 people, his top people, got together, and they knew which way the wind was blowing, and they knew who was going to win this war. It wasn't Germany. And they thought, who do we want to work with to continue our plans to go to outer space? They didn't want to work with the Russians because the Russians had that reputation. They weren't happy with the Germans after Stalingrad. And they didn't think the British had the money, so they decided on the Americans. And they sent von Braun's young brother down the mountain where they were staying near the end of the war to talk to the Americans who were down there, and one thing led to another. And we co-opted them and scooped them up, about 127 of them, and shipped them over to America to teach us all about ballistic missiles.
Hmm. Good move.
Well, at the time, you know, they signed, I think, year contracts or something, because at the time, we hadn't, the war in Japan was still going, and, you know, it looked like from all signs that we might have to invade, you know, the Japanese islands and, you know, lose possibly a million men. And we needed all the help we could get. So he was originally co-opted and brought over here to possibly help us with some missile work that would be used in World War II. But, of course, the atom bombs put an end to that. So he spent the next 5 years at Fort Bliss working on missiles and showing the Americans everything they needed to know. And, of course, eventually was one of the leaders in the spaceflight program.
Now, the test pilots, how did they come to assign? Like, we know Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins were the Apollo 11 people. How did they go about picking the people there and finding them?
That's an interesting part of it. And, you know, the book and the movie The Right Stuff, of course, which a lot of people are familiar with, that's the early part of the story. And the book's wonderful. The movie's a little less accurate, but it's still entertaining. They, at first, they, when this space program was just getting off the ground, they had no idea what kind of people they'd need. They had no idea what space and weightlessness and would do to the human body. They thought you might black out. They might do something to your brain, make you spacey or start going crazy. At first, they were thinking of putting out, employment ads for people like contortionists and circus people and mountain climbers, people who had done rugged things. But then Eisenhower said, you know what, that sounds, I don't think we need to do that. We've got, why don't we just, we've got all the records of military test pilots, and they looked through about 500 records of military test pilots and whittled that down eventually to 30, and they tested, 31, they tested 31 in those legendary tests that went on for weeks, psychological, stress, physical, just unbelievable tests, and just some crazy stuff. They were just, a lot of the space, the astronauts called them, you know, sadists, some of these scientists and doctors, because they were just practically making up experiments, you know. But they whittled it down to 7, and that was the first group of astronauts, the Mercury astronauts, you know, John Glenn, Alan Shepard, people like that. The next group that came out in 61 was Neil Armstrong's group. They called them the New Nine. Those were also test pilots. After that, those were culled from about 725 men. After that, astronauts didn't have to be test pilots. So the first two groups were test pilots. The next were not. But they had to have, you know, it was a high bar. They had to have thousands of hours jet time, pilot time, things like that. And they did go through tests, but nothing was as bad as those first ones that the Mercury 7 went through.
Hmm. You know, the do we know how they got along and how and what really happened between the three pilots?
We have a pretty good idea. I talked to two of them. Neil Armstrong died 4 or 5 years ago, so, and he was kind of a private individual. I don't know if I would have been able to talk to him, but, you know, lots and lots of interviews. A book was written about Armstrong with his corporation. That's as close to an autobiography as you can get. And it's clear some crews for these missions, especially Apollo, which was a three-man crew, were like brothers. They showed up at the same time. They zoomed off from training at the same time. They ate together. They partied together. Not these guys. These guys respected each other, but they weren't especially close. Their personalities were very different. Mike Collins was fairly sophisticated. He had been the son of an Army general. And Army generals don't get rich in the Army, but they are treated like royalty wherever they're stationed. And so he grew up, in a little higher class trappings and knew his way around a French wine list and a French wine cellar. He had a good sense of self-deprecatory sense of humor, real affable, very genial guy, although very intelligent. He was an excellent command module pilot. Neil Armstrong was very quiet and modest and unassuming. He had an ego. All these guys had an ego. They were alpha males, but he was, very controlled and quiet, didn't say much unless he felt something had to be said. And Buzz Aldrin was, by his own admission, not someone who was good in social situations, wasn't good at double talk. Other astronauts and their wives were terrified of being seated next to Buzz at some dinner or event because he'd go on about orbital mechanics or rendezvous, two of his passions for hours. And once you get Buzz Aldrin going on a subject, it's like turning on a computer. He was actually called a human computer by some people. He was the most brilliant of those early astronauts. And, of course, we know he wasn't happy when Armstrong was picked as the commander of the mission. Well, Armstrong was already the commander, but he wasn't. But when Armstrong was picked as the man who would step out first onto the lunar surface. And Buzz to this day will tell you that Neil Armstrong was not the first man on the moon. He and Buzz were both in the lunar lander and landed on the moon at the same time. So they both landed on the moon at the same time. And he had been told at some point, several months, maybe 5 or 6 months before the July 16th launch, 1969 of Apollo 11, that he was going to be the first man out for a variety of reasons. But then some top NASA brass got together in a secret meeting and decided, who's going to be this? Who do we want as this Lindbergh-type figure who will be the most famous person in the world, who will endure, intense, perception from the media and the world forever? And they decided it was going to be Neil Armstrong, modest, unassuming, quiet Neil Armstrong, and not Buzz. They didn't, blame him for being ambitious, but they just decided it was going to be Armstrong. And they told Buzz that it was because the lunar lander, which was very small, not much room in it, when their suits were pressurized to go outside, they kind of ballooned up and almost no space in there to maneuver. And Armstrong was on the left down where the small door opened up to, get on your hands and knees and back out onto the outside porch of the lander and go down the ladder. So they said they told Buzz that was the reason that Armstrong had been chosen as the first man out.
Jim, did they, we understand obviously the tests were quite, archaic, if you like, and quite spontaneous and not particularly well planned before the selection of the astronauts originally. But what about the psychological impact? Was there any thought given to the impact in preparing the astronauts for flight, for what they'd experienced, the aftermath, and the effects on the family?
That wasn't... Well, the family, it's funny you bring that up. You know, that was back in the day, the late 50s, when, you know, things were a little different than they are now, and they were asked at the press conference announcing these seven men, you know, they were all asked about questions, and each one was asked about what, you know, what his wife and family felt, and, you know, they all said, well, she's behind me 100%, pretty much, you know, variations on that.
Mm.
And it wasn't given much more thought than that, but whenever the wives were interviewed, they were always asked about what they thought about what their husbands were going to do, because this was back when rockets blew up regularly, and they were just, the press and the public, the American public and worldwide, seemed to be shocked that these women were seemed accepting that their husbands were willing to climb on top of, you know, a rocket that was a rocket booster that was meant to convey nuclear warheads and strap themselves on top in a small capsule and be sent up into the air, hopefully into space, because no one knew what was going to happen to their bodies in space or whether, you know, the rockets would blow up. But everybody just seemed stunned that the women seemed fine with this.
Do
so, no, there wasn't much, much, you know, consideration given to that. And there was a book written, a few years ago called The Astronaut Wives.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Club that you might be familiar with, they did a one-season TV show about it also, because the women bonded together, of course, because no other kind of wives could understand what they were going through, because it was a unique thing that they were going through, being the wives of astronauts. And, you know, after a while, these astronauts got so busy training, flying all over the country at various places that were making various parts of the spacecraft, and they had to test them all the time, and actually helped them make these things, because all these astronauts had engineering backgrounds. They were expected to be kind of partners in this, and some of them barely got home, maybe, you know, one day for their on the weekend to see their family and remind their kids that they had a father. So there were all sorts of problems like that with the families.
But as far as we know, there wasn't any kind of preparation for the families in regards to, you know, potential bereavement or...
No, there wasn't at all.
Wow.
No, there wasn't at all. And when, you know, a few astronauts died in accidents, usually fighter, jet accidents going... They spent so much time in jets flying around the country that, you know, it was inevitable that some of them were going to die, and I think four of them died, and three or four of them died in those accidents. But when the first major accident in the spaceflight program happened in January 1967 in the Apollo Command Module spacecraft with Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee, who were going to be the first crew to go into space aboard a manned mission of the Apollo spacecraft, and they died in January on the launch pad, ironically, not even in space, and in what they called a plugs out test to see if it could the capsule could work properly on its own power, in internal power. And they were working in retrospect, it seems so obvious that this was just a dangerous thing waiting to happen, but they were, the atmosphere inside the capsule was 100% oxygen. And if, as anybody knows who's blown on a fire, what happens with oxygen in a fire is it's just absolutely combustible. And all it took was a spark, and they had lots and lots of combustible, non-fireproof, flammable things in the capsule, and everything caught on fire, and they were dead within a minute, mostly from inhaling noxious fumes. They did get burned, but that's not what killed them. So that came as a shock. It almost stopped the entire program. People were stunned at this. But nobody knew, that just came as a shock, and two of them were buried in Arlington, and one was at West Point, and the families at that time, they didn't have many rights to anything or any kind of pensions or anything. And one of the Gus Grissom's widow eventually sued NASA and settled out of court. Well, I don't know if she sued NASA or one of the command modules construction company, North American, and settled for an undisclosed amount.
And we understand, I mean, this was such a significant event, such an achievement, that these guys, you know, that they were absolutely notorious, infamous afterwards for the rest of their lives, so and continue to be. So how did they manage that? Do we understand how they managed that initial recognition? And they were heroic, weren't they, for a long time?
Well, they were, and, I mean, when they announced these first, especially the first seven Mercury astronauts, they became instantaneous heroes, and they were a little embarrassed because they hadn't done anything. They were, top flight test pilots, of course, but there were a lot of other test pilots that didn't get selected, and they hadn't done anything, and they were instant celebrities, and somewhat embarrassed by this. As I said, nobody expected this. They weren't given any classes on how to deal with the press or anything, like as now happens with, sports, young kids who get selected high up in a draft or something, who, start playing in the NFL or the NBA. They didn't have anything like that, so they had to kind of learn. It was touch and go. They had to learn as they went. And when the Manned Spacecraft Center opened, the NASA's headquarters moved to Houston in 1962. The men who were training, even though they hadn't done much, there was just constant demand all over the country for them to appear here and there, speakers, you know, be at the opening of this supermarket. You know, you could go on and on, the things that celebrities do. And they would, they figured out a way, they would, they'd each take a week, and they'd do a bunch of that stuff. They'd take a week off from training, and they call it a week, their week in the barrel. And, you know, they'd go around the country and do various things, dinners and events, things like this, openings, you know, sometimes White House or government related. And then they'd all take a week and take turns doing that. And none of them really liked it much, because it was just so tiring and boring, of course. And it took them away from what they really wanted to do, was train to go into space.
And their experiences, you mentioned that they weren't particularly close, and yet they were sharing this amazing experience together, in which their lives relied on the responsibility of the man next to them.
Well, you're absolutely right. It was a yes, and especially the same men on the crew. For instance, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong trained much more together than they did with Mike Collins, who was the command module pilot, you know, the command module, the main ship that all three, the mothership, if you will, that all three of them flew. Well, they didn't really fly, but they went to the moon in, and then, of course, Collins was the command module pilot, and he continued to orbit the moon, while the next day, Aldrin and Armstrong slithered through a small connecting tunnel into the lunar module, and pressurized it and pulled away and, you know, landed on the moon. So that was the most dangerous aspect of it. So they trained hundreds of hours together in simulators to do that, and while Collins trained alone. And I talked to a man who was a simulator technician, and he worked with them, and he said sometimes when they finish a simulation or a test landing, that there would be complete quiet in the simulator, and you know, sometimes it went on, there wouldn't be any small talk, and you know, all the other crews, they'd talk and laugh and tell jokes, and between Aldrin and Armstrong, there hardly a word. And sometimes the technicians felt like that maybe they should go up and look inside and make sure they hadn't fallen asleep.
Oh, wow.
So that tells you something. That tells you something about the relationship between Aldrin and Armstrong.
Did they have, or have they spoken about particular fears that they had? I mean, clearly there would be the fear that this would go terribly wrong, but any other fears that they had before they took off?
They were asked that a lot, and I asked that, and there's a good amount of material on that from them, from the very early beginnings. Of the program, the Mercury astronauts. Wally Schirra made a good point. He said, we trained so much that we trained the fear out. We trained the fear down to apprehension. And, of course, nobody liked to use the word scared or fear. Although Gus Grissom did when he returned from his the second Gemini, the second Mercury mission. He said he was scared and a lot of the other astronauts kind of raise their eyebrows at that because they didn't want to admit they were scared. But they trained so much in so many ways on different simulators that they got to know the system so well and the spacecraft so well that you know, they felt confident enough. Of course, they all knew that anything could happen, but they were impressed with the safety standards, which were just, you know, way off the charts, because they had to be. Anything went wrong with somebody, you know, anything goes wrong with a car on the road and, you know, the car just stops and you're okay. Anything goes wrong in space and, you know, very good chance that you've got dead astronauts, you know, orbiting the Earth forever. But they all said they just didn't think about that because what was the point? They were also asked, and some people asked me if I had asked astronauts this, didn't they have a poison pill that they could use just in case?
I was going to ask that.
Well, yes, because a lot of people do. But, you know, they said, why did we need that? first of all, we'd be way too busy trying to figure out, you know, how to get out of whatever situation we were in. For instance, Apollo 13, of course, which did go wrong when the oxygen tank exploded. But even if it got to the point where it was absolutely hopeless, all they had to do was depressurize their suits or open one of their ports or, you know, pull up their visor and in, you know, like 20 seconds, they'd be unconscious and dead within a few minutes. So nothing was going to, you know, that was going to work a lot faster than any poison pill. So it wasn't necessary. They just didn't give it much thought. And dying, the possibility of dying just and death just wasn't something they spent a lot of time on.
Do we know how much? I mean, we know that there was a phone call made from the president to them. There's that communication. But do they have communication at all with family members while they were on the mission?
No, they didn't have actual communication with family members once the mission started. They could have, you know, patched in, just like they patched in the president when they put up the flag on the moon.
Yeah.
They could have patched in a relative or a wife or something, or the families. But, you know, they had a lot to do. And Apollo 11 especially was, you know, they just had a lot of work on their hands. And once they landed, you know, they got out and they spent maybe 2.5 hours out there, and they had several experiments to do, and they had things to do, and they just barely had time really for the phone call for the president. So it just wasn't deemed necessary that, you know, their families talk to them by phone.
What was the plan, or did they have a plan, for if the astronauts didn't make it, or they weren't going to make it, or something happened, they run out of gas? You know, there's you know, of course, there's gossip about suicide pills and things like that.
Right.
Was there any such thing?
Well, there wasn't, because, you know, they were just trained to the nth degree and to figure out some way out if the situation arose where things took a bad turn. You know, if they had, for instance, when Armstrong and Aldrin landed on the moon in the lunar module, they had, you know, maybe a couple of days of oxygen and power, you know. So if they, you know, flipped that switch, pushed that button that started the ascent engine, because they had a descent engine which brought them down, and then they had an ascent engine which was different. If they pushed that button, it didn't work, they would have had a day or maybe two tops, and there's nothing they could have done. Michael Collins in the command module might have gotten down to about 20,000 feet above, because he was many miles above orbiting the moon, and he might have gotten down to within about 20,000 feet orbiting the moon, but he could not have landed or gotten anywhere near the moon, anywhere near the moon's surface. So if that ascent engine hadn't worked, there's nothing they could do, and they would have died on the moon. Absolutely nothing they could have done. The funny thing is that when Aldrin was maneuvering in the lunar module with a pressurized suit, and just before he got down and moved out through the small door and out onto the porch, he busted off a piece of plastic that was absolutely necessary to arm the ascent engine. It was a circuit breaker, a piece of plastic circuit breaker. He busted it off, and he didn't know until they came back in and he saw this black piece of plastic sitting there, and figured out it was the ascent engine arming system. In other words, it armed it and made it ready so it would work when they pushed the button. And he told Mission Control, and they said they would figure out a workaround. You might have to go outside and putter around with some circuits or systems. But he said, I've got a plastic pen. Why don't I stick this in and see if it will arm it, you know, with a circuit breaker. And he did it, and it worked. If it hadn't worked,
yeah,
they might have found a workaround, but who knows?
Yeah. Well, you know, that also brings up a point of how long ago this was, and what kind of computer did they have on board? What kind of, things were on board at the time compared to what we have now?
Yeah, let's talk about computers. The computer, this was a time in the late 60s when, mid to late 60s, when a computer, an IBM computer, like a 790 or 794, took up, a large room. But NASA told MIT they'd need something smaller. So just a couple years before, this little thing called the microchip had been invented. So they ordered a million microchips, which, by the way, kind of really kick-started that industry. But and they came up with this thing called the Apollo Guidance Computer that had, it was about the size of a briefcase. It was a disky, display with a keyboard. And it had, get this, 72 kilobytes of memory and a grand total of 1 megahertz processing speed, infinitely less than my old 6S smartphone, which has 32 gigs of memory and something like a 1.85 gig processor. There's a million kilobytes in a gigabyte. So there's several million times more memory and processing speed in my 6S than was in that primitive computer. But the funny thing was, it was a dependable little thing. It was a core rope thing. They had, hundreds of little of these microprocessor chips, cores, and, copper wire strung around them. And it was primitive, but it worked for the tasks assigned to it. One of those was landing the lunar module on the moon, kind of. It could land them using velocity and altitude, things like that. But it didn't know what was there, where it was going to land them, if you see what I mean, whether that was on the side of a crater or where there were some boulders. And coincidentally, when it was landing them, that's exactly where it was going to land them, on the side of a crater with lots of large car-sized boulders in it. And that's when Neil Armstrong took manual control, or kind of manual control, and landed it himself.
Wow.
So that computer, the Apollo Guidance Computer, there was one on the lunar module, the command module. Good for a few things, but had its problems.
Oh, yeah.
The first, one of the very first portable computers, if you think about it.
Yeah. Yeah, so quite different. Now, what did the astronauts have to go through, or put them through after they landed? Like, were they in some sort of isolation or tests or anything?
Well, they all did very heavy debriefings of everything and discussed ad infinitum and ad nauseum every anomaly being something that was odd, something that was off, something that wasn't supposed to happen, that was an anomaly. But the Apollo 11 mission was special because they were going out, stepping out, and actually making contact with an alien world, another celestial body. And a lot of scientists brought this up several months before, probably a year or two before, and convinced NASA that they had to take precautions. So when they got back, they were put in this special a large trailer that had been adapted for their use, and there were a few people in there, like a couple of engineers and a doctor with them. They were supposed to be in there for 3 weeks to make sure that they didn't bring back any strange lunar organisms or germs that could, or bacteria that could possibly cause havoc to our system. We've seen all those TV movies right around that time, a book and a year later or so, a movie called The Andromeda Strain came out that was exactly about that. But once they did that, once they realized the the moon was dead. There was nothing living on it, and it just wasn't necessary. So it was discontinued for later missions.
Wow. Wow, quite a feat. And when it took over 400,000 men and people involved to pull this off?
400,000 men and women, Americans, working at 10,000 contractors and subcontractors, because this was a high priority, and of course it was a race, and they weren't just letting one company do it. Grumman in Bethpage, Long Island, built the Apollo lunar module, and North American in California built the command module. Other parts of the country, other contractors, companies did all sorts of other parts, 10,000 subcontractors, 400,000 people working there, making all sorts of parts, and also people, technicians, scientists, engineers at NASA, at many laboratories around the country, and universities, things like that. So yes, this was a group effort by lots of Americans, and they prided themselves on safety, extremely high safety standards. One time, Gus Grissom, early in the program, Gus Grissom of the Mercury 7 was short. He was about 5'6" and very taciturn. He didn't like to talk much, but he was very sharp, as they all were. He was sent during his week in the barrel to I can't remember what large subcontractor, and he was supposed to get up and do a speech before hundreds of people that worked there. And he just got up and he said, "Do good work." And the people went crazy. They just loved that. They did posters with, his face that just said, "Do good work," and it worked. They, all these companies prided themselves on their safety standards because they had to, because their lives, American lives, were at stake.
It's just amazing. Wow, that's a lot of people to have in on the conspiracy.
Wow, weird. I guess we got to that. Yeah.
That costs a lot of money.
A lot of people, and oddly enough, not one of them has said this was a conspiracy. Well, I didn't make any of these parts, and if they, I'm a skeptic in a lot of ways. I'm a skeptic about maybe Roswell, maybe the JFK assassination. You know what? The science has settled on this. It happened, and it drives me crazy that some people don't believe it happened. I mean, there's so much evidence. If you really want to look. There's tons of evidence online, everywhere, in books. It happened. And if it would have been so outrageously expensive to somehow fake it, if they could have, and if they were going to, why did they do it 6 or 7 times? And if the Russians had known this, we were in a race with the Russians. The Russians would have known absolutely if this was faked, and they would have made that public. So, yes, it happened, absolutely.
The Russians are in on it too. Come on.
The Russians were in on it too. Yeah, not the what's that group that is supposed to be of the behind the scenes people that run everything.
Oh, the deep state.
That too. And before the
deep Illuminati.
The Illuminati. Yeah, I mean they're all part of that. They're all a part of this. I don't know what the final goal is if the Russians and the Americans are working together, but they still are. But we're not going to go there.
No, we're safe. Well, it's been very, very good conversation. I love that. Now, do you have contact information or a website or anything that people could contact you on and send you pictures of?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to hear anybody who's got questions or has read the book. I've got a website. It's jamesdonovan.net with all sorts of things about that book and my other two books. And people are welcome to go there. And, of course, the book, Shoot for the Moon, came out a couple months ago, and it's wherever fine books are sold and other places online available. Sure.
Fantastic. We'll have it up on our website as well, linked right below the player. So once you listen to it, you can just do one click and buy it. So, James, thank you very much for taking the time to talk a little bit about your book.
Oh, this was my pleasure and privilege. Thanks, Al.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now. Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.